Hello, my name is Brian Quinn. I'm an attorney, and I'm here today on behalf of Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, or as we are more commonly known, LCL. We are a lawyer's assistance program here in Pennsylvania. Today, my presentation is entitled The Impaired Lawyer, A Call for Action. I'll give you a little bit of information about myself. As I mentioned, I'm a licensed attorney here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Private practitioner for a little over 40 years, former member of the Board of Directors of Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, and as of 2017, I have been their Education and Outreach Coordinator. LCL, as we call ourselves, has one thing in common with many other lawyers' assistance programs in the country. And that is that we carry out a life-saving service. Our mission is to provide a caring peer assistance program to save the lives and restore the health and professional competence of judges, lawyers, members of their families, and law students who are at risk as a result of alcohol and drug use, gambling, depression, or other serious mental illnesses. We carry out this mission through a combination of confidential helpline services, volunteer support, and education. And I am the educator. We here in Pennsylvania feel that the education and training programs that we do like these are as important as anything that we do, because this is how we reach as many members of our profession as possible and hopefully alleviate the fear, the misunderstanding, and the stigma that surrounds alcoholism and mental health issues. Because we feel that what you don't know about those issues and subjects will hurt you and our profession. So I do want to spend a little bit of time discussing lawyers' assistance programs. First and foremost, caveat, I'm from Pennsylvania. There is, at the end of this presentation, some slides that have to do with some national resources. One of them is the American Bar Association's directory of state by state. You need to contact your state's lawyers assistance program. Let me also say this. There's a slide on here that has all of our information here in Pennsylvania. If you ever have any questions about your own state's plan or program, call us in Pennsylvania, and we'll be glad to help you, direct you to the right people, and we'll assist you in any way, shape, or form. And that does often happen when I do presentations like these that are heard in many states in the country. One of the things that I want to mention is probably the most important thing about lawyers' assistance programs, and that's that we're confidential. The ABA has a conference every year of lawyers' assistance programs in this country, and they always ask all the members who participate in that conference the same question every year. What is it in your state that prevents lawyers from using the free lawyers' assistance program that you provide? And the number one answer, year in and year out, is always fear that someone will find out. Fear of disclosure. Fear that it won't be held confidential. I cannot speak for every state. I cannot speak for every lawyers' assistance program. I can take a fairly well-educated guess that confidentiality is at the top, is the top priority in any lawyer's assistance program. You may remain anonymous and still receive our services. You must consult your state's as the result, or just whether it's the result of their impairment or not, because frankly, by the time they are calling us, they're not quite sure whether they are impaired or they're not impaired by any of those issues that I previously mentioned. So this fear of disclosure of unethical conduct is also a great concern. Once again, you must check your own state's rules of professional conduct, ethical conduct. But I can tell you that the courts in most states recognize that judges and lawyers may become ill and need to seek specialized treatment. The courts further recognize that fear of disclosure will prevent many from seeking help. We have a rule here in Pennsylvania that I have seen repeated word for word in many other states' rules of professional conduct that provides an exception to the duty to report that type of conduct that would otherwise be required and mandated that it be reported. Those rules usually do not require disclosure of information otherwise protected by the rules of professional conduct or information gained by a lawyer or judge while participating in an approved lawyer's assistance program. And most courts have followed that up by stating that providing for such an exception encourages lawyers and judges to seek treatment through such a program, and that conversely, without such an exception, lawyers and judges may hesitate to seek assistance from these programs, which may then result in additional harm to their professional careers, additional injury to the welfare of clients, and to the public. So it's very important that you check your own rules, but I can tell you that, for the most part, lawyers' assistance, if we couldn't assure people that their calls would be held confidential and that they would that they could remain anonymous. And by the way, I want to mention something else. For the most part, lawyers' assistance programs do not only assist the practitioner. We assist their families. Once again, check your own program. But I can tell you right here in Pennsylvania, we don't just help the lawyer, we help the lawyer's families. Why do we do that? Well, because they're part of your life. And if they're part of your life and your family member, and I don't mean immediate household, I mean your extended family, anyone who can connect themselves in any way, shape, or form by blood marriage, former marriage, to an attorney qualifies for our free confidential services. Because if it affects your family member, you're the lawyer of the family, after all. So sometimes you may actually see it in your own household. And as I'm recording this program, we are in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. And there is a lot of shut-in orders in almost all states right now. So we are getting to be in close quarters with our immediate family. Some of our family members who do not live in the same household may be suffering from mental health issues, substance use issues, alcohol issues. And it doesn't matter why, but if there's ever been a communal traumatic event like this, it certainly hasn't happened in my lifetime. So that's why we help family members, because they're part of your life and they will impact your ability to practice law. So the attorney who's perfectly fine and has no issues at all, but has a family member that's impaired, is still going to have their ability to practice law efficiently, productively, and ethically challenged by that family member's impairment. And we don't want that to happen. So that's why we help. But let's take a look at lawyers. Let me start off by saying that the ABA also recognized that there was a there had not been any sort of study done in the area of prevalence rates for lawyers pertaining to their drinking, use of drugs, or their mental health issues. So back in 2015, they retained the services of Patrick Krill, K-R-I-L-L, licensed lawyer, also a certified drug and alcohol counselor. And Krill worked in conjunction with the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation in Minnesota. And together, the ABA and Hazelden Betty Ford funded this study. Nearly 13,000 lawyers were surveyed. They had to be qualifications, had to be that they were licensed lawyers and also employed in some capacity in the legal profession. And there were private lawyers, large firms, solo firms, government lawyers, in-house corporate lawyers. So it covered really a lot of areas of practice. So he compiled all this information. And as you'll see on the first slide of the results of the study, which were published in 2016, Kroll found that problematic drinking affected 21% of all licensed attorneys. And that's defined as hazardous or possible dependent drinking. Not just having one or two too many once in a while. Problematic, hazardous, possible dependent drinking. And that rate increased to nearly one-third of all attorneys under the age of 30. That compares with 11% of the highly educated adults in the country, and as you can see on that slide, 6.4% of the entire U.S. population. And Kroll also asked those lawyers about their drug use, and frankly, he could not come up with enough statistics from those 13,000 lawyers to really make a meaningful conclusion, other than the fact that lawyers understate and underreport their use of drugs. Certainly, it's not because lawyers don't use them. They just don't want to talk about it. Alcohol is legal, not to mention socially acceptable. Not drugs. So Kroll's conclusion with respect to drug use in the legal profession was that lawyers don't want to talk about it. And it needs to be addressed. As you can see from the next slide, they certainly did want to speak about their mental health. And these findings are 2015, remember. Depression. 28% of all attorneys suffer from depression. And by that, he did not mean having a sad day, a blue day, the usual mood swings that we all experience. That was diagnosable clinical depression. Stress. 22% of all attorneys suffer from stress. Anxiety, 19% of all attorneys suffered from anxiety, and yes, even higher rates than those among younger lawyers. Now, that survey that was done by Kroll was the first of any type in our profession in 25 years. I think the last one before that was in 1990. Since the Kroll report, as it's more commonly known, was published. There has been a much more recent survey taken. The Mental Health and Substance Abuse Survey conducted by ALM Intelligence and Law.com was sent to lawyers and professionals, really open to anyone working in a law firm setting anywhere around the world. I can tell you that 72% of the lawyers who responded were United States lawyers. The next highest was from the UK. And as I said, there were 3,800 respondents. An overwhelming majority of the legal professionals surveyed believe that their mental well-being is worse off as a result of their chosen career, according to this survey. That survey also shed some light on life inside a law firm and how firm mental health programs are viewed and the causes of mental health challenges in law firms. Really, the numbers are off the charts, and so let's look at some of them right now. By the way, this was published almost 2 months ago, February. I'm doing this in April of 2020. In February the 19th, 2020, this was published. 74% of the lawyers surveyed felt that their profession had a negative impact on their mental health. 44% use alcohol to deal with stress. 64% feel they suffer from anxiety. Remember what the Kroll report was? It was 19%. 64% in this survey felt that they suffered from anxiety, and 31% feel they're depressed. And look at that next number. 18% have contemplated suicide at some point in their careers. And frankly, that number is by itself quite alarming. because that is actually double what the suicidal ideation is among people during their whole lifetime. The lifetime rate of suicidal ideation in the general population of the United States is half of that. So that's not attempted, that's contemplated. Well, as I record this, we're in the COVID-19. I'm doing presentations specifically on that topic, and if you want to hear that, you'll have to wait another week or so before I record the COVID-19 impact on our mental health, which I think you'll find interesting, and I hope that you will subscribe to that one as well. 36% use all of their vacation time. Billable hours. That was one of the areas that was the most stressful to many, many lawyers. 36% feel it had a major effect, and only less than 7% feel that it has no effect on their stress level. So 93% of the lawyers surveyed felt it had some effect or another on their stress level. 62% know a colleague who's depressed, 50% know a colleague with an alcohol problem. And how this next slide tells us something about the firm mentality with respect to these issues. Nearly two-thirds of the lawyers surveyed felt they could not take an extended leave from employment to tend to their mental health issues. Either because it would hurt their career trajectory or are fearful of what the firm would think. 78% and 77% fell into that last category. And ironically enough, 56% felt that they had too much work to take an extended leave. So their work, which may be the cause of the stress, over half of them felt that they had too much work to take an extended leave. I find that last statistic to be rather interesting. So the next couple of slides deal with what I call the common warning signs, AKA what seems to be his problem or what seems to be wrong with her. So let's look at some of these common warning signs. I break them down really into four categories. Most of them are on these next two slides. I break them down as either performance issues, health issues, financial issues, or personal issues. But number one, and I'm not going to spend time speaking about every one of these on the next two slides, but I want to stop on this one and deal with isolation. Wow, very timely. With this presentation of mine, I prepared this long ago, 2 years ago, actually. This particular presentation. Isolation has always been a problem for lawyers. Avoiding interactions has always been a problem for lawyers. We don't want anyone to know what's going on. We don't want to appear weak. So we isolate. That's that door that was always open at the end of the hall, the person inside always accessible. You could talk to them about a case, about an issue, about a even a personal problem. Now the door's closed. The person inside there, but avoiding any interaction with people. Now we have a different type of isolation, social isolation. And as my next presentation that I, once again, I'm going to give a plug for, differentiation between solitude different forms of and isolation, social isolation. There's some changes in physical appearance that go along with I'm not a clinician. I'm a lawyer, and my job here is to raise your awareness level, make your antenna go up when you see some of these things among your colleagues. There's lots of excuses for unexplained issues. Mood swings and increased irritation is another big one. But you see missed deadlines, you see disappearing in unexpected times. Once again, caveat, folks. I don't know who my audience is in full, but I'm going to guess that there are very few who are doctors and lawyers. For the most part, let's assume that we're all lawyers only. Let's not self-diagnose or...
Esquire CLE's first verification code is T. T-E-A. All lowercase. T. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is T. T-E-A. All lowercase. T. Please take a moment and write this down.
Or diagnose one another. And by the way, those surveys that we just discussed, that's one of the issues involved in underreporting, is that we tend to lessen when we self-diagnose. I don't have that, or I'm not quite that bad. And I'll get to that particular issue in a few minutes. And you can see on the next slide, lack of concentration. Any one of these may have a logical explanation. There may be an unexplained emergency once in a while, but when you see these over and over, and the decreases in productivity, and looking and being tired all the time, fatigue is a big telltale sign for stress, depression, anxiety. It impacts our rest, our sleep. So look for some of these things. And the ones that I don't have up here, but I want to mention to you, I don't have on individual slides. I mentioned financial issues and personal issues. Record keeping becomes disorganized. We end up with overdrafts and pop-up. Personal use of client funds, which of course can be a big problem. Judgments, liens, bankruptcies, personal issues can arise in the impaired lawyer's life, domestic issues, arrests, accidents. And then there's that social situation where they stop, the person who's suffering from some of these issues, especially with alcohol, don't want to come to any social functions that don't serve alcohol. So there's a lot of different warning signs. I just wanted to make you aware of what some of them were. The big question is, as you can see on this next slide, why lawyers? Why? Why is this work so necessary? Benjamin Cardozo once wrote that happiness may not exist in a successful lawyer's life. Is it the stress that starts in law school only to be heightened upon graduation by our realization that the qualities we possess that made us good students are not necessarily those that will make us good lawyers? But more importantly, are the qualities that make for a good lawyer, that they may not necessarily be the same that make for a happy human being? Some people suggest that it's the practice of law itself, that it's the profession, that we're now in a adversarial win-lose process every single day. One lawyer's win is another lawyer's loss. Thus, the drive to win can become paramount in the quest for the competent, zealous representation of our clients that we are ethically bound to exercise. Let's face it, positive emotions are part of a win-win game, whereas negative emotions switch into play during a win-loss game. So to the extent that lawyering now consists of more win-loss games, there is going to be more negative emotion in the daily life of lawyers. We're trained to be aggressive, judgmental. We tend to be thinkers, not feelers. We're intellectual, we're analytical, emotionally detached. Those types of feelings produce predictable emotional consequences for the legal practitioner. He or she will be depressed, anxious, and angry a lot of the time. The problem is that when lawyers are faced with emotional distress, they tend to judge themselves harshly simply for feeling that way. We're problem solvers. We don't have problems. And if we do, we're not going to admit to them. When we fail to address stress, anxiety, depression, and other personal issues, it usually gets worse and can lead to addiction or a breakdown, and thus the impaired lawyer, because we're dealing with diseases that are chronic and progressive. They do not get better on their own. When I went to law school, they told me they were going to teach me how to think like a lawyer. And then they did. And then they did. And it's not always easy for that lawyer's mind to wrap around certain things like the disease of addiction, which has as its most powerful symptom the fact that it tells us we don't have it. There is no other disease known to man that has that type of a symptom. Cancer doesn't tell us that. This COVID-19 virus doesn't tell us that. Heart disease doesn't tell us that. My arthritis does not tell me that my knee doesn't hurt. Not so with addiction. Its most powerful symptom is the fact that tells us, you're okay, you're not one of them. And those unique aspects of our personalities as lawyers, combined with that adversarial nature of the profession and the high pressure and the high speed environment of the law firm, contributes to not only stress, but ultimately, if we don't address that, it can lead to burnout and other problems like that. Leads to a sense of helplessness. And when that happens, we start to self-medicate, and we can have even more problems. So knowing all of this, as you can see on this next slide, what keeps judges and lawyers from seeking or accepting the help they so desperately need? Well, we feel that there are four major barriers, the first of which is shame and embarrassment. Stigma. The stigma that surrounds and is attached to addiction and mental illness in our society as a whole is disproportionately magnified in the legal profession. Instead of admitting we have a problem and asking for help, we are often overcome with the shame and embarrassment of being labeled an alcoholic, a drug addict, depressed, bipolar, much of which is caused by the misconceptions and stereotyping that surrounds those illnesses. And that shame and embarrassment is then reinforced by the fear of how public disclosure may harm our reputations and careers, or embarrass our colleagues in the bar or on the bench, or our families. What's it going to look like if people find out I have a problem? Second one on that list was denial. Someone with high-functioning substance impairment or mental health disorder is able to hold down a job, socialize with friends, maintain intimate personal relationships while demonstrating a pattern of dysfunctional behavior. The high-functioning alcoholic or addicted lawyer still suffers from an addiction, but it's harder to see evidence of the problem unless you're looking very, very closely. They're usually able to hide their signs of drinking by restricting it only to certain times or in certain situations. They push back. After all, we're trained to argue our cases. We justify and we minimize all the time. And that's how, as you can see on this slide, who me? Someone can be stressed, depressed, but still well-dressed. Very hard to see. So let's look a little bit more closely at dealing with denial. Because denial is the most common challenge associated with getting a high-functioning alcoholic to seek treatment. These individuals honestly believe that their alcohol use is under control. Trouble with the law. They haven't been disciplined. They don't feel that the alcoholic portrayed in popular culture. And in many cases, they think that only someone who's hit rock bottom meets that criteria. Of course, that's one of the cunning, baffling, and powerful attributes of the disease itself. You're not one of them. You're not one of them. You're different. You've got this under control. You've got this under control. But complicating this problem further is the tendency of the attorney's peers to indulge in what I call a conspiracy of silence. We call it enabling. And lighten the normal stresses of our profession. When, for motives, good, bad, or mixed, colleagues protect the impaired individual from the consequences of his or her illness-based misconduct, the result is a progression of that illness to the greater detriment of career, family, and well-being. So I want to spend a couple of minutes on this very, very difficult aspect of how we help our colleagues and how we hurt our colleagues. And when I use the word protect, if you could see me, I was putting imaginary quotation marks around that word protect. We think we're protecting. We think we're protecting, but we're not. We're removing the motivation to change. We're providing evidence that fuels that denial. When you enable someone, you take away the natural consequences of their addictive behavior, and their motivation to change goes right along with it. If you're always there, coming up behind and sweeping up the mess they make, they see no real need to change. Because individuals who are struggling with addiction can be experts at convincing themselves they don't really have a problem and that their addiction is not really that bad. And removing the natural consequences of their behavior may just, in their eyes, provide the evidence that fuels their denial. For them to be interested in even thinking about treatment and recovery, the pros of stopping their impaired behavior have to outweigh the cons. So if you really want to help them, stop enabling them, so that the balance can be tipped in the right direction. And they'll be more motivated to seek treatment. This is often the bottom, raising the bottom. The impaired individual begins to feel the consequences of their addiction or their mental health issue. They may become motivated to seek treatment before hitting a so-called rock bottom, loss of a job, disciplinary problems, arrest, jail. Enabling doesn't protect, it prevents the treatment of a progressive disease, and it's not good for you either. So real quickly, are you an enabler? Let's look at the next couple slides. Do you rationalize your conduct, your colleagues' behavior? Do you clean up after their messes, ignore new bad behaviors, hide your thoughts or feelings to avoid angering a colleague? Do you lie and make excuses for them, to clients or coworkers? Do you resent them because they don't seem to care about their own situation as much as you do? You help them by lending them money, rescue them when they get into some sort of trouble as a result of their impairment? Do you give them those ultimatums and back down every time because you know you're not going to meet them? And then give them that million last chance? This is the last time I'm going to do this for you. And by the way, I'll add a number 11 on there. Are you more worried about how it's going to look for your firm if you reach out and tell someone there might be a problem with such and such in the firm? How's it going to look for the firm? How's it going to look to our clients? Do you put that ahead of your colleagues' best interest and their health and their life? Tough questions to ask ourselves. But they need to be asked. I often say that we don't all get along. That would be unrealistic and well, it just isn't the way things are in this society. We don't always get along with our colleagues. But maybe we can act as if we care. Act as if we want to help them, even if we don't always agree or always like what they do. Act as if they do. Try just being civil, even if it has nothing to do with your own game. I always tell people that it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking about someone than it is to think your way into a new way of acting. So we want you to avoid enabling. Don't wait till a crisis develops. Don't try to diagnose or treat the problem yourself. Don't ignore. Of job, and guys, do accept help, please. Never discuss a colleague's referral for help with anyone else. That Krill report that I mentioned earlier had a conclusion that education aimed at preventing, along with public awareness campaigns within the profession, they're designed to overcome this stigma that I've been talking about, was necessary. And that the confidential nature of lawyer assistance programs should be more widely publicized to overcome the privacy concerns that create barriers between attorneys that are struggling with these issues and the help that they so desperately need. Our number one goal is to overcome the fear associated with saying, I need, it's okay, and no one need find out. So I wish it was as simple as this next slide. Yes, balance is the key. Balance is everything. Work-life balance. Work-life is two words, folks. It's not work-life, it's work-life balance. And you can see what happens when we lose that work-life balance. We're heading in the direction of burnout. So what can you do? That's you at the center of that ripple. That's you picking up a phone. That's where the ripple starts, with you and that little device that weighs, gosh, I don't know, several grams, less than an ounce, maybe. It weighs 100 pounds when it comes time to picking it up and using it to ask for help for yourself or for a colleague who's in trouble. Just pick up the phone. Start there. When you call on behalf of someone else, you do not have to do anything else but just make the call. You're not signing up for any intervention show. You know, we do assistant interventions in the lawyer's assistance program world. So let's look at some of the questions that we see over and over. To call or not to call? These are the questions that we hear all the time from the person who has a problem and isn't willing to ask for help. I'm okay. I can work this out for myself. I'm not like a real alcoholic anyway. I want help, but I don't want anyone to know. We won't tell anybody. Will I be reported to discipline? Nope. Not in most states. Not in any state that I'm familiar with or else I'd tell you right off the top of my head. Once again, check your rules. I already tried to get help and it didn't work. I don't have the money to pay for treatment. There are many lawyer's assistance programs. I know I can speak to the one here in Pennsylvania. To pay for treatment, we will find it for you, either private sources or public funding sources. Many, many states have a lawyer's assistance program that is attached to a foundation that can assist an attorney who doesn't have the money to pay for treatment. Because yes, by the time an attorney needs treatment, we don't want money to stand in the way of that. We in Pennsylvania offer free initial evaluations for substance use or mental health. We want that person to hesitate to get the initial evaluation. So we do pay for those. And I think there are many other states that do the same thing. As far as other long-term treatment is concerned, that will be based on a state-by-state basis, because we have found that by the time someone needs this help, they often don't have insurance or funds, because their addiction and their illness and their impairment has gotten to the point where they are financial. What will they say if you don't ask for help? What makes you think people don't know already? It's no use. Nobody will understand. I give up. As far as calling for someone else, all of those on that slide have to do with you're minding somebody else's business. I don't want to get involved. I don't have time for somebody else. Maybe it'll get better on its own. When you don't reach out, as you can see on this slide, out of some misplaced sense of loyalty due to fear, anger, retribution from someone else that you work with in the firm, this mind my own business attitude, people get sicker and people die. And that's where lawyers' assistance programs come into play. We exist to assist judges, attorneys, and law students in distress but we can't help if you don't call. I put the Lawyers Concern for Lawyers of Pennsylvania contact information and questions. You could always call us. I don't care what state you're in. I don't care where you are in this country. You can call us to start with, and we'll point you in the right direction. Or, as I mentioned, there is a state-by-state directory at the conclusion of this presentation. Because when you do call us, we help to identify the possible approaches if there's someone that you're concerned about. We discuss the pros and cons of each approach. We'll advise you what to say or not to say if you're calling about someone else. And we will even participate in that if necessary. As I said, you can remain anonymous if you're calling about someone else. And don't forget the family members. Don't forget your family members. We want to help them too. Okay? It's all very important. It's all tied together. You know, Patrick Krill, when he did that study, said that the results were incompatible with a sustainable professional culture. That was his conclusion for his entire report. So we think there are steps to sustain this culture in the legal profession. The stigma that's associated with it. Education, which is why I do the programs that I do, and making health and well-being a top priority throughout the profession. That's what we do, and that's why we do it. And that's why I'm called the educator here at Lawyers Concern for Lawyers of Pennsylvania. But I'm going to take that hat off for a second, and I'm going to put the hat on of Brian Quinn, the lawyer, and tell you something else about lawyers' assistance programs in general and LCL of Pennsylvania. And that's that we save lives. And I know that because my life was saved by Lawyers Concern for Lawyers of Pennsylvania. All I ever wanted to do was be a lawyer for as long as I can remember. You know, I was probably before I was even in high school, probably saw a television show or something. But all I know is that everything I wanted to, every time I was asked, what do you want to do? I want to be a lawyer. Come from a very middle-class working family in suburban Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I'm the only member of my family. I had three siblings, mom and dad, and of the six of us, I'm the only one who went beyond high school. I worked my way through college because my family could not afford to pay for my college education. I worked in a grocery store. And I went to Villanova University for my undergrad work. And all the while, I'm not going to say that I didn't have any fun, or that I was a goody two shoes, but I was just a normal, hardworking student who took a public transportation back and forth to the campus every day. I did not live in a dormitory. Was accepted to Villanova Law School. And that summer between college and law school, I was going to work one day and I met a man who was campaigning for public office. He was running for the state legislature in this part of Pennsylvania. And introduced himself. He asked me what I was doing, and I told him I was. I just graduated from college, and I was getting ready to go to law school. He said, "Oh, great." He said, "I'm a lawyer. I have an office here in town. Why don't you come and see me if you've been in school for a couple of months?" So I did. And during our conversation, he asked me if I'd like to be his law clerk, and I was delighted, to say the least, and said yes. So I spent the next 3 years. And he was a sole practitioner, very well-known member of the bar, very well-known member of the community, as I mentioned. I did that. And then that day came, and I took the bar examination after I graduated. And the day came when I got a letter from the Board of Law Examiners in Pennsylvania. And it said, "Congratulations, you've passed the Pennsylvania bar exam." So my mentor said, "Great." He said, "I have a big case in court tomorrow. Why don't you come? You can sit at counsel table with the client while I make my presentation. I'll introduce you to all the judges and the lawyers that will be there tomorrow. And I'll introduce you as my soon-to-be new associate." So I went to court the next day. I was seated at the counsel table next to his client, and he stood up to present his case to the court.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is ART, A-R-T, all lowercase, ART. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is ART, A-R-T, all lowercase, ART. Please take a moment and write this down.
And he was at the podium in front of the bench. And about 5 minutes into his presentation, he fell to the floor of the courtroom dead of a heart attack. He was 43 years old. And just at the snap of a finger, the blink of an eye, my whole life changed. I watched. He was not resuscitated. There were no rush to the hospital. No. He died on the courtroom floor, and I watched them put his body into a body bag and remove it from the courtroom. And my whole world was just topsy-turvy. My dream of learning my profession at the hands of my mentor were over. He was a sole practitioner. His family said to me, Brian, George had no associates. We need you to take over his law practice. And all I had was a letter that I had received the day before from the Board of Law Examiners. I wasn't a lawyer yet, but I had to be admitted by swearing in at the Prothonotary of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania's office in downtown Philadelphia. Just me, I was standing at a counter at the Prothonotary's, stood next to a lawyer that I didn't even know, who moved my admission to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. My mentor's desk in his chair. And the people that were coming into the office were there to see me. And I was terrified. I had anxiety. I had panic attacks. I thought, I don't know what I'm doing. The only reason I'm sitting here is because he's dead. I don't know what to do or what to say. I was terrified. I didn't know what post-traumatic stress disorder was. I thought that was something that people that came back from war had, soldiers. Certainly not lawyers, and not because they were lawyers, but I know now that's probably what I was suffering from. And I'm not going to kid you. I was a rather successful young lawyer. I was able to maintain a lot of his clients in practice, and he was a politician, and many of his colleagues in politics approached me to get involved in politics as well after a few months went by. I got involved. And things progressed, and the practice got bigger and bigger and bigger. And the only thing that didn't go away and got bigger as well was my anxiety, my fear, and my self-doubt. I thought I was a fraud. I thought I would go into court, and just imagine going into the same courtroom, let alone standing at the same podium, where I had seen that man drop dead, how it made me feel. I was paralyzed. Sometimes I would literally have to leave a courtroom in the middle of a sentence, not a sentencing, a sentence, and walk out. And people would just say, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with him? And I'd say, I think I'm having a heart attack. And I'm a healthy young man at the time. I'd go to the hospital. I'd say, I think I'm having a heart attack. They'd say, you're not having a heart attack. And I'd do it again. I'd do it again because these panic attacks wouldn't go away. And when they wouldn't help me, and when they said to me literally at the hospital, don't come back anymore, you're fine, I started to self-medicate. And at that time in my career, I could associate drinking with going out with clients, going to a meeting. Before I knew it, I was being asked to be the solicitor of boroughs and townships and governmental authorities and zoning boards. And with all these different things going on in my life, I was saying, yes, I'll do that. Yes, I'll do that. I was married. I had a young son. And everything seemed to be great on the outside. Nice house, had a couple of cars. Everything was great except inside of me. And my drinking started to become every day. And I could disguise it because I'd drink with this group on Monday, this one on Thursday, this one on Wednesday, this one on Tuesday, this one on Saturday and Sunday. and I was a man in my early 30s at the time. When drinking wasn't enough, I began to turn to drugs. And I don't mean prescription medication that was prescribed by a doctor. I mean illegal drugs, cocaine. By the time I was in my early 30s, I was using cocaine every single day. I was using alcohol every single day. I seemed to be making money, but I couldn't pay my bills. Rescuing houses from foreclosure, rescuing the car from repossession, trying to move all those shells around, all the pieces of the puzzle. I was walking a tightrope. I lived two lives. And I didn't want any of those two lives to meld into one another, lest someone find out what's really going on in my life. So as a result, I just kept it hidden and hidden and hidden and hidden even more. And it got worse and worse and worse. And I thought no one knew. Well, my wife knew. And she said, you've got to stop all this. You have two. Now, by then, I had two young children. And she said, my wife had two young sons. And things were progressing even worse. My wife said to me, you've got to stop this behavior. And I did. I did stop my behavior by moving out of my house. I left her and my two sons. My addiction was much more powerful than my family. So I did that, and things progressed. As I mentioned earlier, these are progressive diseases. I didn't know any about this. I thought I had all this under control. My political aspirations were still in place, and I had a friend at the time who was a member of the cabinet of the President of the United States. She was from my county here in eastern Pennsylvania. And she invited me on more than one occasion to the White House. And I remember going to the White House on one occasion, and it was on a Sunday afternoon. And she took me around, and we get to the Oval Office, and there's a Secret Service on either side of the doorway of the Oval Office, and I'm looking inside the Oval Office, and there's the bust of Abraham Lincoln and all the things that we see on television all the time. And there I am standing there in the White House, and in my left pocket I had a bag of cocaine, and I thought it was perfectly normal behavior. No one had searched me. I was with a cabinet member. Same thing when I was admitted to the United States Supreme Court. I met Chief Justice Berger, who was the Chief Justice at the time, while in the possession of drugs. It was just the way I lived. I didn't know how to stop. I got divorced, and then things got even worse. I ended up saying the house was foreclosed upon. I lost the house at foreclosure proceedings at a sheriff's sale. My office building, same thing, lost to a sheriff's sale. Because that would have revealed that something was wrong in the life of Brian Quinn, and I didn't want anyone to think that. All those things that we try to hide, let someone know there's a problem. Well, as I said, these are progressive issues. In the year 2000, I was arrested for drunk driving in the state of New Jersey. I represented myself, did nothing about it after I was released, did not comply with any of the terms of the court, and they issued a bench warrant for my arrest. A licensed Pennsylvania lawyer with a bench warrant in the neighboring state of New Jersey. Then I was in Florida 5 years later, once again arrested. Driving under the influence. Once again, I represented myself on those court conditions, and they issued a bench warrant for me in the state of Florida. Two states, two bench warrants. My solution, don't go back to Florida and don't go back to control. As my blood pressure went up, as I started to develop congestive heart failure, neuropathy, my Keith's hair fell out. But I've got this under control, I said. I don't need help. Well, that all came to a big change in the year 2008, when in my own hometown, where I had lived all my life since I was a child and had my law office my whole career, and by then it was over 35 years, I was arrested by the local police and, yes, charged with drunk driving and this time possession of 27 empty packets of cocaine that they found in my car, strewn everywhere, under the mat, under the seat, in the glove box, in the console, in the visor, everywhere, in my pockets. They put me in a jail cell, and of course I knew them all by name because I had practiced law there. And I remember them saying, we're going to take you to court in the morning, Brian. I said, that's good. I said, maybe you can ask the judge for a continuance for me since I have a case there. And they laughed, of course, and said, no, you can ask for it yourself because we're taking you there for your arraignment. And they led me into handcuffs, into the courtroom in handcuffs, to appear before a judge I had helped get elected to be arraigned for my third drunk driving. Now, I had practiced enough criminal law to know that I was going to be going to jail because three DUIs in the course of 8 years meant a mandatory jail sentence. And I was so concerned about that that when they released me from jail that morning, I went right back to the bar I'd been in the night before and sat at the bar at 10 o'clock in the morning and had a drink wearing the same clothes that I had on the night before. And nobody said a word because it wasn't that unusual to see Brian Quinn in a bar wearing the same clothes at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I still did nothing about it. And months went by and months went by. And I finally went to see a lawyer friend of mine and told him what had happened. And he said, Brian, do you think you have a problem? That question that day, I had been asked that question many times in my life, folks, and I had always said, no, I'm okay. I got this under control. That day, that question changed my life because it's the day I said yes. But what my friend did next saved my life because without hesitating, he picked the phone up on his desk and called a lawyer he knew was involved with lawyers concerned for lawyers. And the person at that other end of that phone said, will you accept our help? And I said, I don't have any money. Don't worry about it. We'll find you funding. What'll people say? What makes you think people don't know already? He answered. The question is, will you accept our help? And I said, yes. And they found me a facility and they helped get me funding. I was a charity case. I was a lawyer who had lost his home, lost his office, had holes in my shoes, not a dime in my pocket, owed money. I had stolen $50,000 from a client estate account. So I was a thief, an alcoholic, and a drug addict, and a Pennsylvania licensed lawyer all at the same time. And I didn't know what to do. And I finally said yes. And that's the last day I had a drink or a drug. Was that day, because I went into treatment. And while I was there, I was visited by someone who, and by the way, I hadn't bought in yet. I was still kicking and screaming a little bit. Puzzled when they told me that I had a visitor, and I said, that's impossible. I've told no one that I'm here. They said, someone's asking for you by name. So I went down to the cafeteria in that facility. And it was a very modest facility. Frankly, it was used primarily by the Pennsylvania State Penitentiary System for parolees and this lawyer named Brian Quinn. And this man introduced himself. He stood up and said, my name is John D. And I'm an LCL peer volunteer. And I'm here to see how you are because I know how you feel. And all I could think about is, who are these people? And why do they do this? And then I was visited again by someone who did the same thing and said he was going to take me to a lawyer's recovery meeting. And all I could think about is, why? Why do they do this? Well, when I got out of I was called by my case, I was, because eventually, I did have to go to court. And I stood in front of a judge that I had known since he was before he was a judge. For 27 years, I had known him. And he told me that he had to sentence me in accordance with the law, as difficult as it was. He said, indeed, it was the most difficult sentencing he had ever done in his career. And he sentenced me to 1 to 2 years in prison, and I went to prison. And while I was there, I did give up my license to practice law, never knowing if I'd ever get it back. And when I got out of prison, I was became a peer volunteer with Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers. Then the Disciplinary Board of Pennsylvania finished my case and decided not to disbar me, but rather to suspend me for 5 years. So between 2010 and 2015, I was suspended. But I went to work helping other people in a nearby drug and alcohol treatment facility, making $11 an hour, no driver's license, and a parolee. But in 2015, the Supreme Court saw fit to reinstate me to the practice of law. And that's when I was asked by LCL to become their educator. I have to close with this. We're lawyers. Lawyers impact all aspects of society every single day of our lives. Just imagine the impact an impaired lawyer is having every single day. It's up to us as lawyers to ask the question that may change someone's life. It's up to us as lawyers to make the call that may save someone's life. Thank you so much for listening today. Remember, all of our numbers are on this presentation. Please reach out and call us if you have any questions at all about this presentation, about your state's Lawyers Assistance Program, or anything else. Because we're here to help you, but we can't help if you don't call. Once again, thank you very much.